Yeah, so I mean, those are the things I went to prison for, which is crazy, but yeah, so I used it first, and then I decided, oh, this is actually a good thing. I'll sell this. And
so you got caught eventually.
Oh yeah, went to prison.
How old were you?
19.
19. And how long were you in prison for?
Until I was 25.
Oh shit.
Yeah, 19 to 25.
And I know a lot about your drama from one of your podcast episodes. You went into it. It was really interesting. But I think the thing that really inspired me was how when you were there, you said how like they would wake you guys up at like 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And it was just like this abrupt, rude awakening, bright lights, yeah. Super noisy. And like, as we mentioned before, a big part of your personality is like the silence.
Yeah.
That introspective time. And so like you talked about in the episode earlier, in the GMBM episode, about how like you used to get up really early, like 4 a.m.
Four, yeah.
Some crazy shit like that.
I still wake up at 4 every day.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I wake up at 3:50, but yeah.
Same difference. Yeah, at that point, it's 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But then like, I mean, it wasn't good coffee, but you would just like have your cup of coffee.
Terrible coffee.
You would clean up, but it was like, that was your time.
Yeah.
And eventually, I mean, obviously you didn't jump to owning Omen, but eventually that's kind of what brought you to where you're at right now.
Well, it just turned me into the person that could do what I'm doing now. So feel me when I bring it, sing it loud. I'm from the loop
and I'm proud. Run a mile for the cause. I'm righteous above the law. Play my styles. Hi guys, it's your girl Nakama, your favorite Jew from the Lou. Welcome back to my podcast. And today we are here at Omen Coffee and we are doing an interview with Mark. And I'm so excited because, you know, I wouldn't be here without you, honestly.
Aw.
You're the reason why I'm doing a podcast.
Really?
Literally.
I really appreciate that.
For real. Like a year ago, you in January did your first like group opening.
Yeah.
With the Give More Be More podcast.
Yeah.
And I had heard you and Jeff start your podcast ahead of time. And I remember I've always been a podcast girly. But I had never known anyone personally who had done it.
Oh.
And so I was fangirling a little bit.
Yeah.
And I remember telling Jeff, like, I need to meet him.
Yeah.
Because the longer I wait to meet him, the more I'm going to fangirl.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be like a normal connection.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we met when we did that first, you know, group meeting last January.
At Jeff's gym.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you had a second one a few months later, and it was actually, we all got to be live.
Yeah.
And I remember hesitating at the end when you opened the floor to anyone to ask questions.
Yeah.
Because I was like,
I got you.
You did.
Yeah.
I was the last one.
Yeah.
And I remember I waited, I think, 3 weeks to listen to the episode.
No way.
I did.
Because you wanted to. Because
I was scared to hear my voice.
Yeah.
And I remember my voice was a little shaky.
Yeah.
But something happened to me when I held that mic for the first time.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you remember, but the question that I asked was, what do you do when you're killing it at your job, but it doesn't set your soul on fire?
Yeah.
You don't know what sets your soul on fire.
Yeah, I don't remember. And I also don't remember what I answered, but I bet you I told you to quit.
You didn't tell me to quit. You actually said, it was really good advice, but you said that sometimes it's okay not to be the one to have the vision. It's okay to find someone who has the vision and like join them.
Yeah, 100%. You know? And I agree 1,000% with that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I just kept thinking about it and I thought about, well, if money didn't matter, what would I want to do?
Yeah.
And I love talking to people.
Yeah.
And so when I asked you that question and I held that mic, as scary as it was, it also changed the trajectory of my year.
Yeah. And now you have this project.
Now I'm here. And now we're here.
Dude, I love the Jew from the Lou, the branding, I know you're a graphic designer, so like you get all the credit for that, but it's freaking awesome.
But I made it at Omen.
Yeah.
I was sitting in your little corner of your cafe downstairs.
Dang, that's fire.
And that's where I made it.
Yeah, that's sick.
I remember Lau kept coming over and checking on me and just seeing where I was at with it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh man, she's the
really
best.
Sweet.
Lau's mom.
Yeah. It's so great. Her episode's actually going to be coming out this week.
Oh, sick.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go. I'll listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. But I really was so intrigued with your story because I've picked up bits and pieces of it throughout the different episodes on the GMBM podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about when you're listening to a podcast is you've got all these questions firing in your head. And you think sometimes you're having a conversation with the interviewer because it's so raw and real, a podcast.
Yeah.
But I'm not actually there.
Yeah.
So the fact that I'm here and I get to finally ask you these questions is surreal.
I'm pumped.
Yeah.
I'm pumped. Especially since you never submitted them in the question box for Mailbag Monday.
I know. Well, that's because I don't know why I never did.
Fate. It was fate.
It was meant to be, I guess. Yeah. Timing is everything.
Yes.
Okay. So let's start from the beginning, because I think who we are is all based on our childhood. Mm-hmm. And so I know that, like, I really don't know much about your childhood, except for that you had said you were in foster care, mm-hmm. and that you had gotten into some trouble in high school.
Yeah.
So would you be comfortable opening up with us, telling us about your past a little bit?
Yeah, I think I've shared my full story on a bunch of different podcasts now, but yeah, I mean, my upbringing, I guess, it's so funny. It feels weird to call it childhood because I didn't feel like a child for very long in my life, but my upbringing was split into two portions. There was like 0 to 11 and then 11 to 16. And I say 16, I left my parents' house when I was 16 and I have lived on my own since, but.
Now, is this your birth parents?
Or no, my foster parents. Your foster parents. Yeah. So whenever I say my parents, I'm talking about my foster parents, but 0 to 11, I was like in and out of foster homes with my birth mother had custody of me, my biological mother. So my biological mother had custody of me from 0 to 11, and she would like seemingly regularly get like arrested or go to rehab or, you know, any number of things would just disappear. And so we would end up in foster homes. Mm-hmm. And so for the first like 11 years of my life, that was sort of the cycle. I would spend some time with my biological mom, and then, you know, I would go live with a foster family for a relatively short amount of time. And then I'd go back to mom, back to foster care, back to mom, foster care. During that time we were like, you know, we were homeless. You know, I've stayed in women's and children's shelters. My mom was addicted to cocaine and alcohol. So like I had been abandoned in crack houses for like, you know, days and days and days at a time, molested and abused by strangers. And I say molested, like I was regularly kind of physically abused my whole life from my mom. Not my whole life, sorry, 0 to 11. My mom was the kind of mom that back then I thought was normal, but like, you know, she would just grab, like the way she would whoop us, it was like she would grab anything that was in arm's reach, like shoe, spatula, belt, extension cord, like anything. And that's what she would beat us with. And I thought that that's like how everybody got disciplined. But it turns out it's not. I mean,
Would you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I just say it was normal to me, but that was a regular thing. And there's like this thing with children of addicts where they say that sometimes they have like adult complex from a very young age, because it's like the parent is the child and the kid ends up taking care of them. Well, that was kind of, I had that, whatever that is. It made me feel like, you know, at a very young age, like 5, 6, 7 years old, I felt like I was the man of the house. I had to take care of my mom. So that was sort of the dynamic that I grew up in. But just recently I've started talking about like sort of being molested, for lack of a better word. But I have this memory that's like one of my earliest memories. And it's funny because most of my childhood is blacked out. They say that like when you go through a lot of trauma, you just suppress a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, I mean, over the years, I've unlocked a lot of memories. But like when I was 18, for example, like I couldn't remember anything. Like my memory is so bad that it's like a running joke among my foster family. Like they'd be like, my mom will be like talking and there would be a group of us and she'd be like, oh, do you guys remember when we went to that place? And I'm like, oh, of course Mark doesn't remember. Like that kind of thing. Like, cause I just don't remember anything. But one of my earliest memories is like being abandoned in this crack house. I know where it is. To this day, I know where the house is. Like it's so crazy how specific the memory is. It's in New York, where I was born. And I remember there being another young girl, a young female that was like similar age. And like we were like pretending like we were doing inappropriate things, right? We're like we're having sexual intimate behavior, and there was a grown man there like watching, and I just remember vividly him like masturbating like to us. And so like I was never physically molested, but like that's like that was like one of the earliest memories I have, and it's you know, so anyway, that was my childhood, like just crazy shit like that, like crazy shit. Like I remember I've got us kicked out of several apartments because like I was so bad. I would go on the roof and throw rocks at other people's apartment windows. Wow. You know, just all kinds of dumb, but it was just because, man, I was just struggling. You know?
You were just acting out.
Yeah. And so, yeah, man, I just run of the mill childhood.
Just normal, yeah. Everyday stuff.
And then,
what else? Were you separated from your siblings at any point, or were you guys kept together?
Well, yes and no. I have a lot of half siblings. Like, I have a lot of siblings that I don't even know.
Oh, yeah.
My father, I never knew my father. I never had a relationship with my father. So he has kids that are my half brothers and sisters. In addition to that, my older sister, who's actually my half sister, my mom's daughter, she was on and off living with her father, living with us. So like, yeah, but the one constant, my whole life was pretty much, my twin brother. So whenever I would go to foster system, he would go to the foster system. Whenever I would go back, he would go back for the most part. So yeah. And then when I was 11, I was, man, it was one of the most traumatizing things that actually ever happened in my childhood. Even more so than the, you know, sort of the molestation, was when I was 11, my mom, Matt and I had been separated for the first time in our lives. He just asked my mom one day, he was like, "Hey, can I go live with Laura and Dennis," which is our foster parents. And my mom was just so fucked up that she was just like, sure. And like gave him away. And so at the time we were living in Florida. So she sent him up to New York, which is where my foster parents live. And we were separate. Okay. So first time in our lives that we had been separated. And then like, I don't even know how much time passed, to be honest. If I gave a number, I would just be guessing, but I don't know how much time passed, but it wasn't long, like a couple months. And my mom was like, "Hey, we're going to go visit your brother. You know, let's go on vacation. We'll just take a trip." And so she flies me up to New York. We like pack our bags. And, you know, I was really excited to go visit both him and Lauren Dennis. And get on a plane, like all kinds of stuff. I was excited. And so we get there, and long story short, like we got there, we didn't even like go to Lauren Dennis's house. We like got in a, back then it was a taxi. Mm-hmm. I'm old. We got a taxi.
No, they still have taxis.
I know they still have them. Nobody uses them. But we got a taxi. We go to this building. We go inside. And my mama just sat me down on a bench and she's like, "Hey, wait right here. I'll be right back." And yeah, she just left me sitting there that day. Like she never came back. And next thing I know, like Lauren Dennis were there and they came out and they're like, "Hey, you got to go home with us." And I was just so fiercely loyal to my mom. I was like, "No, fuck that. I'm not going anywhere. Like, where's my mom? Where's my mom?" And they like, I remember that they had literally had to like, you know how adults will, I don't know, I guess that's not normal either, but they had to grab my legs. So one person had my legs, one person had my arms. They had to carry me out to the car and like put me in the car and send me home because I did not want to go anywhere. And yeah, that was the last time I seen my mom for like several years. Last time I even spoke to her.
That's really traumatizing.
Oh yeah, it was crazy. And so now you have these other parents that are like trying to like be my new parents, but I'm like, I'm so loyal to my mom. Mm-hmm. And the way it happened, like if it happened differently, if my mom would have just been like, "Hey, you got to, you know, go live with this is Lauren Dennis now because it's better for you and they are better, you know, whatever."
It was abandonment.
They're more,
there was no,
but nobody explained it to me. Yeah. Right. So like, I have this, I'm just so hardened and I have this wall up and I won't accept anything. And it was so bad the way that it happened. And it kind of like, it definitely influenced the way that I showed up from that point forward because I was super rejecting. I rejected especially my foster mom. Like my foster dad, I never had a dad. So it's not like you're trying to take anybody's place.
Right.
Like I kind of liked him. I liked him a lot, you know, but my mom, we fought like cats and dogs because it's in my head. I'm like, "You're trying to be my mom and you're not my mom. So fuck you." So yeah, anyway, but my life got better. Like, this is interesting. When we were talking the other day, you were like, it seemed like your life, you know, you had like privilege in a sense privilege and poverty, which is true. Like, I mean, definitely, I mean, my foster family is poor. My foster father was the only income in the house with five kids, and he only made like $60,000 a year. So it's like, you know, if you, I mean, you, I'm sure you make somewhere. You're poor. You got five. Imagine having five kids and making the same money that you make now.
I actually saw a TikTok about that where it was like me scratching my head, wondering how I'm barely making any money when someone who has five kids is
doing the same thing.
I don't know how people do it.
To this day, it blows my mind because I never felt like I was missing anything with my foster parents.
To be fair, I do think that like $60,000 then went a little further.
Way further. Way
further. Today. Yeah. Just saying.
Yeah, 100%. But it still blows my mind because I mean, like, I played sports every season of the year.
Yeah.
You know, we traveled. We got to go school shopping every year. Like, it was just.
Money comes from mysterious places.
It is. It really crazy. Does.
I mean, I know I've talked to a lot of people from different faiths. I'm Jewish, obviously, but I could definitely speak from my faith where we believe that, like, a lot of people who are trying to plan their life.
Yeah.
They'll be like, well, I need to have, like, everything just prepared before I have kids. I'm not financially prepared.
Yeah.
And in our faith, we believe that the money comes with the child.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. God provides when you need it.
When you need it.
Exactly.
Exactly. Not before.
I'm kind of with you a little bit. I'll dive into situations.
It's 50-50, though. I still think having some sort of a game plan is like a good thing to do.
I'll dive in and just be like, well, because honestly, I it's so crazy. I have considered myself a believer for a long time, but I'm sort of exploring religion right now. Mm-hmm. And I went to this thing, it's called adoration. It's in the Catholic, it's a Catholic tradition, but it's basically just like a silent prayer. It's outside of service, outside of mass, usually on a different night or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you just come in and it's silent, but it's a collective prayer. So it'd be other people there. And I went to one with 20,000 people.
That's right up your alley.
Well, yeah, but I'm not, Catholicism doesn't appeal to me at all.
Not necessarily that, but I think the concept of both community and at the same time, silence, meditation.
So let's not talk to each other.
Yeah. You're like, I want to be around my people, but I need like to be introspective.
Yeah,
I feel like that's very much your style.
It was. Yeah. And I only went because I had gotten invited by somebody that is important to me. And so I said, okay, I'll go, whatever. And it was really cool. But I left and it's interesting because sometimes, which it kind of blows my mind that people can be like atheists. But anyway, I go to this thing and it was silent, so like there was no sermon, there was no message, but I left with a very clear message. Mm-hmm. Even though it was a silent prayer, which was so cool. But anyway, the message that I left with the other night was that you have to start walking. You have to walk first, and then God shows you the way. Because I always say that, like, yeah. I pray a lot for guidance, right? Mm-hmm. And so I would imagine a lot of people do, and a lot of people think about it, like, man, I just wish I knew, you know, what the path was for me. Well, in my experience, and also the message I received the other night was like, you don't get to know before. You just have to like walk in the way that you think is, you know, best for you. And then God makes the way as you walk. And so I think a lot of people want that reassurance before they start. It's very similar to what you're saying. They want to have a plan that's bulletproof before they start. Like, no, you have to just go.
Yeah.
If you feel called to go in a certain direction, go in that direction and the path will illuminate.
Fun fact.
Yeah.
Just going to interject for one second.
Go ahead.
So fun fact about Judaism is we believe that before we became the Jewish people, the Torah, which is like what our faith is all based on, was presented to every nation in the world. And what God did was every nation had like their struggle. Maybe it was murder. Maybe it was whatever it was, right? Yeah. And he would like tell them what was like their hardest struggle. And he was like, well, the Torah says you can't do this. And so for the Jewish people, he actually didn't tell them anything that was in the Torah. Our hardest struggle as like the Jewish people is not being able to know before we accept something. And so the Hebrew phrase that we said was Nasa Vinishma, which means we will do and then we will accept.
And then you will accept. That's right.
Which is exactly what you're talking about, which is really, 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 really hard.
It is very hard.
Yeah.
But you know, it is, but it's not. Once you acclimate to it, it's like doing hard things, right? It's like putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. It is hard at first, but once you acclimate to it, it's just, you realize the value of it, and you realize, mm-hmm. and your faith grows so much stronger, because like that's genuinely how I live. And this is before, you know, like I said, I've just recently revisited sort of organized religion. Like this is just I think I have this thing that I say often, which is real faith has no fear, right? Mm-hmm. Or real faith has no hope. I think faith and hope are, fear and hope are two sides of the same coin.
Interesting.
And when you have real faith, there's nothing to be afraid of. When you have real faith, also, you don't make the plan. Like, it's so interesting. I was talking to one of my most enthusiastically religious friends recently, and I told her, like, I never ask God for anything in particular. And it's because I think there's like, that would be an assumption that I know what I need. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get my hopes up that it's going to go this way or that way, because I have complete faith that if I just keep walking, he's going to make it happen the way it's supposed to happen. And he knows how it's supposed to happen. I don't know how it's supposed to happen. So anyway, I got to digress. So I just want to finish up my childhood. But so when I went to my foster parents, it was really good, but I was a very angry and violent child.
Yet you also mentioned that in high school, I've heard you say a bunch of times that you were like an honor student. You did very, very well in school.
Well, that's because
which is not typical. Usually when you hear kids with a background like yours, this is why I was confused about your background. Mm-hmm. Because typically kids who come from dysfunctional homes, who've gone through trauma, who are angry, who maybe don't have parents who are present, they typically do not do as well in school. That is not because they're not intelligent. Sometimes they're the smartest kids in the class.
Yeah.
It's simply because maybe they don't have the right environment at home to do their homework. They don't see the benefit of it. You know, it's just their way of rebelling, another way of rebelling.
Yeah.
And so I was really surprised to hear that you did so well in school, considering your background.
Well.
So what inspired that?
I like learning.
Okay.
Like it's.
As simple as that.
Yeah. Like it's not, if I didn't like it, then I might have done bad at school. But like, I genuinely like learning. Mm-hmm. And I'm competitive. Mm-hmm. Like I like being the best. So like when you put those two things together, like even in, you know, I mean, there's classes that I certainly did worse in than others. Yeah. And a lot of the times when I look back on those, it was because I didn't like the teacher. Mm. It wasn't because I didn't.
Big believer in that.
It wasn't because I didn't like the topic. It was because I didn't like the teacher.
I'm a big believer in that. Like it all depends on the teacher, because
100% it does.
If you have a great teacher, they could totally change the way you feel about whatever subject.
They can get you interested in anything.
Absolutely.
If you talk to anybody about something that they're passionate about, it's interesting. Doesn't matter what it is. Like it's always going to be interesting because they genuinely enjoy telling you about it, and they do it with enthusiasm, right? And so anyway, I like learning, and that's why I did well. And then also I'm a very good test taker. It sounds so weird for me to actually say that because I don't consider myself that, but the truth is I've never failed a test in my life. Never. Not one ever. And I've never studied for a test in my life. Mm. So like I just, for whatever reason, am able to, I don't have the best memory. I really don't. It's not like I memorize things. I'm not not that kind of student, but like I'll soak up enough information to be able to like deduce to the right answer. Or if it's like an essay based thing or something like that, well, I can speak well enough that I can sort of bullshit my way. Mm-hmm. But that's how I had good grades. That's the only reason I'm explaining this, is that one, I did like learning, but even if it wasn't something I didn't like learning about, like I'm a good test taker. So, and most of your grade is derived from the tests.
Right. And you did well in sports.
Yeah, I did well. Well, I really only played basketball seriously. Mm-hmm. I played like tennis for a season. I played soccer for a season. I played football for a season. I played, I only wrestled. Maybe, did I ever wrestle? I don't think I wrestled organized, but I did. My brothers did. So I like was around wrestling. Basketball was the only consistent sport.
Okay. I mean, I've seen you playing basketball in Lifetime. So,
That makes sense. Bro, it's my game. Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Wait. So, okay. I need to understand then. So, like, you had this like really difficult and challenging childhood, but then you did well in school, you did well in sports. Usually that would mean that you would go well, hopefully, and excel in your adulthood. But then you ended up in prison. So fill in the blanks. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, so things kind of normalized when I went to my foster parents' house, with the exception of like my home life. Like my home life was so bad because I was just so, I can't understate that. Like I was so angry mm-hmm. and I was so hurt and I was so hardened. Like I'm still, some people consider me still that way, but I'm so much softer than I used to be. And I mean, to the point where I would get violent with my parents. Like I would, you know, yeah, there's no other way to put it. Like I wouldn't strike them, but I would like push them out of my face. I would scream at them. Like I was just violent with my parents. Mm-hmm. They called the police on me, I think more than once. Like, so I was just, my home life was crazy, but I would go to school and everything would be fine. Like no big deal. Mm-hmm. And, the only person that I really took to in my foster parent in my foster family was my older brother. And so I would spend a lot of time with him. He'd teach me a lot of things. And he was just the coolest dude ever, at least in my mind. And he was, let me see, 8 years older than me. So he's a grown-ass man, and I'm in high school.
Is he your biological brother?
No, or foster brother. He's my foster parent's biological son.
Got it.
And so,
you really bonded with him.
Yeah, I really bonded with him. That was like kind of my safe space in my new family. And then when I was 16, Travis is his name. Travis died, like really suddenly, honestly. Like it was, he was an athlete. He was a, you know, at the time he was 24, but like he'd always like been in like going to the gym and like staying in shape. And it's apparently he like tore his rotator cuff in his shoulder. He didn't have any health insurance. So he was just trying to like figure out what to do and started taking pain medication to like manage it. And honestly, like less than a year later, like he was dead. He overdosed on opiates. And it was just tragic. It was really, really tragic. And so after that,
how old were you?
16.
You were 16.
So, yeah. Honestly, I handled that pretty well. Like I say, well, but in retrospect, terribly, because I didn't like accept it. I didn't work through it. I didn't grieve at all. But like the next day I woke up and went to school, like nothing happened. Like, and I sort of just kept on and, my home life deteriorated very quickly. This is why I left my house when I was 16, because me and my parents, like were sort of, it was more tense than ever. I was still smoking weed and my mom like kind of associated weed with the kind of drugs that my brother just died from. And she's like, yeah. Your brother just died, you know, and whatever. And so that we were coming to a head with that argument. So I just left one day and now I'm living on my own. I don't want to drop out of high school. I want to keep playing basketball. I want to play basketball in college. So, you know, I have these things and I'm juggling it. And, yeah, my basketball career ended like really abruptly, and with it sort of like all the hope that I had to like be a normal kid. So my brother had died and I was like really struggling with that, but I wouldn't let it on. And I was just very like sort of emotionally sensitive. And my long story short, I was the star of my team. Like I was the best player on the team and I was already getting looked at from colleges and I was a sophomore. So I was in 10th grade and I just kind of was arrogant too. You know, it was just big ego because I knew I was good and our school was a basketball school. So basketball was important there and all this stuff. And we were playing our rival team one night and the opening tip, the other team's point guard comes down, shoots a three right in my face. He makes it. And not a big deal, really. But we're like a defense first kind of school. My coach is definitely an old school basketball coach, like defense wins games kind of philosophy. So he was pissed, but we go down, we have a possession, we lose the ball. Same kid, same point guard. He comes down, shoots another three right in my face. Doesn't even pass the ball. Like just shoots, pulls up right in my face, makes it. So my coach pulls me out of the game. And I was kind of pissed because I actually played good defense. Like it was just better offense. Like the kid just hit the shots. And so I was like, you know, kind of mumbling under my breath as I walked by my coach, but he wasn't the kind of coach that like, you don't do that to him. So long story short, he ends up not putting me back in the game for the whole half. Like, we go into halftime and I still hadn't went back in the game. And I think it was because I was mumbling under my breath and he wanted to teach me a lesson. But I was like so arrogant and I knew I was the best player and all this stuff. And I was like, so in my head, I'm like, fine, you don't want to put me in the game? I won't play. And I went in the locker room at halftime and I put my fucking, I took my basketball shoes off. I put my sandals on, put my sweatpants on, and I didn't go back in. And then the next day I like walked in. I was just so mad about it that he benched me for the half. I went in and I put my uniform on his desk and I was like, fine, you don't want to play me? Then I'm not going to play. And I quit. And, you know, it seems extreme. It is extreme, but like, you got to understand how much emotional turmoil I was going through at the time. Like,
you were also a 16-year-old kid.
Yeah, I was a kid, but also like, I just was going through so much. I'm living on my own. I'm trying to pay rent and go to school as a high schooler. The whole, you know, like just, and I was giving everything to basketball, you know? So for him, in retrospect, benching me for a half of one game is not that big of a deal. But at the time, it was like, dude, I'm giving everything I have to this. And like, if you're not going to play me, then why the fuck am I wasting my time? So anyway, I handled it so bad. But I went in and I still didn't think that that was the end of the world. But I was just going to quit the rest of the season, come back the next year, have a great, you know, junior year and whatever, and go to college and play basketball. But before the end of the year, the athletic director calls me into her office and she tells me, hey, you know, basically you'll never be able to play basketball here ever again. Like, your basketball career is over because I quit. She's like, once you quit, it's over. So you can play a different sport, but you're not playing basketball. And that was sort of the nail in the coffin for my childhood, because I was already struggling to keep it together. I was, you know, living on my own. My twin brother was living on his, you know, out on the streets. He was just homeless, like friend's couch to friend's couch to friend's couch. I at least had a place, but I wouldn't let him stay in my place because he was addicted to drugs already and I wasn't doing drugs. So like, we were going through it. And and basketball was like the reason why I would keep showing up to school and taking the tests and getting good grades and all the things, because I wanted to play basketball. So when you take that off the table, now I'm like, well, fuck it. So I just went full blown smoking weed, selling weed, you know, and I would show up to school only on test days so that I could pass the test and then leave and keep my grades and just graduate. And truly, I was thinking about dropping out of school, but I told them straight up. I went to them, and they, and to their credit, my high school, great people, I told them everything that was going on. And I'm like, listen, I want to graduate and get my degree. Like, I know I'm close, but like, I'm not coming to school. I'm not coming to school every day. So like, if you guys would just let me show up and take the tests, and if I pass the test, then, you know, be fair, I'm not asking for any favors, but if I pass the test and I'm retaining the information, then like, don't hold me accountable on the attendance thing. And they were like, why don't you just double up? Take twice as many, you know, classes, show up on test days, and you can graduate a year early. So that's what I did.
Oh, wow.
So they worked with me and that was cool. And that's why I have my high school diploma today. But yeah, so that was kind of like the nail in the coffin. Basketball career was over. And then I went and I just became a super big stoner, selling weed, just feeling sorry for myself for honestly a couple years after that. And it spiraled into going from selling weed and smoking weed to doing psychedelics and then selling psychedelics.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So like, doing it yourself caused you to end up upgrading, if you will, when you would sell more.
Yeah. You know why? This is going to sound fucked up, but I'll never sell somebody something that I don't really believe in. And like, it took me
doing. That is a fucked up form of integrity.
It took me doing psychedelics to realize that there's nothing really, like, that I wasn't hurting people. You know, like that's the thing. Like, for example, my brother died from drugs that somebody sold him. Mm-hmm. I've never sold a drug like that.
Right.
I couldn't do it. That's just not the kind of salesperson I am. Yeah. So once I got introduced to psychedelics, because I thought about them the same way that everybody does when you're a kid. Well, I'm not doing that. You know, you're going to be fucking crazy. You're going to get stuck in an acid trip or, you know, whatever. But once I did it, and I mean, honestly, I'm still to this day, I went to prison for psychedelics. And still to this day, I would tell you, I'm a huge proponent, not of regular use, but like, I think every adult needs to have a psychedelic experience, because it's introspective in a way that like, it takes like monks and decades of meditation to tap into a level of consciousness that a psychedelic experience could give you in an afternoon. Like, it's so great. It's so great. I mean, and there's other ways to do it. If you can do it the other way, then cool, do it. Yeah. But like, man, it changed my perspective of the whole world. Like, no, I'm a nicer person. Sure. I'm a better person. I understand the oneness of things. I understand that we're all on the same team. Like, there's just,
yeah, things. I think things are shifting in the psychedelic world.
Yeah.
I've heard more and more podcasts where people open up about that.
We're a little more tolerant of it today.
We have a family friend who I really want to get on my podcast, actually, who's a psychologist. Mm-hmm. And he's a big proponent of actually using psychedelics sometimes to help people.
Probably either psilocybin or MDMA.
Through their therapy.
Ketamine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, those are the things I went to prison for, which is crazy, but I used it first, and then I decided, oh, this is actually a good thing. I'll sell this. And
so you got caught eventually.
Oh, yeah. Went to prison.
How old were you?
19.
And how long were you in prison for?
Until I was 25.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, 19 to 25.
And I know a lot about your drama from one of your podcast episodes. You went into it. It was really interesting. But I think the thing that really, like, inspired me was how when you were there, you said how like they would wake you guys up at like 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And it was just like this abrupt, rude awakening, bright lights, yeah, super noisy. And like, as we mentioned before, a big part of your personality is like the silence.
Yeah.
That introspective time. And so like you talked about in the episode earlier, in the GMBM episode, about how like you used to get up really early, like 4 a.m.
Some
crazy shit like that.
I still wake up at 4 every day.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I wake up at 3:50, but yeah.
Same difference at that point. It's 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But then like, I mean, it wasn't good coffee, but you would just like have your cup of coffee.
Terrible coffee.
You would clean up, but it was like that was your time.
Yeah.
And eventually, I mean, obviously you didn't jump to owning Omen, but eventually that's kind of what brought you to where you're at right now.
Yeah, I really like, yeah. It just turned me into the person that could do what I'm doing now is really the more important point to bring out of that. But it's, yeah, those mornings, those early mornings, like 4 a.m. till 7 a.m. when everybody else got up, or even the first 2 hours, the 4 to 6, like I would wake up every single morning. I had the same routine, and this wasn't the whole time I was in prison. This was like the last 2 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But man, that morning routine changed my life. It really did. But I'd wake up, first thing I'd do is roll off of my cot onto the floor, put my head on the floor, and just like, you know, get in as submissive as, a position as I could, you know, really, really feel it. And
I didn't know that part.
Yeah. I would put my head down on the floor. I would get on my hands and knees and just my forehead. And I would be like, thank you, God. Thank you. You know, and I would.
Like a child's pose almost.
Yeah. Almost like a child's pose. Exactly. No, exactly. And I would go through my gratitude, and that's what my faith, you know, that's where it evolved from, was just a gratitude practice. It wasn't meant to be prayer in the beginning, but that's what it turned into, of just, you know, because I'd be so grateful. And then you just wonder, like, what am I grateful to? And then you could say the universe, or you could say God, or you could say whatever. But like, anyway, that's where it came from. And so I would do this gratitude. And every morning there was like a couple specific things that I would be grateful for. And I still say them today. Like, one is an opportunity to learn and to grow, to teach and to inspire. But then also I would like acknowledge that there's literally tens of millions of people in the world right now that would like literally give their left hand to be where I am right now, in a prison in the United States of America, with 3 hot meals a day and a shower and clean water to drink and all these things. So I would go through that just to reground myself and remind myself, like, I know I just woke up in prison, but it's fine. Like, you're going to be good.
That's a really incredible perspective, considering that like most people's worst case scenario is to end up in prison.
You know? I guess. But when you're there, you got to figure out, you got to be able, in no matter what position you are in life,
mm-hmm,
you have to be able to acknowledge that there's a lot of people, not just one or two, there's millions of people that have it way worse than you do. And that just helps you. It helps you a lot. Like, mm-hmm, it's never productive to focus on how bad you have it. It's always productive to focus on how good you have it. Like, and there's always an opportunity for you to build either narrative,
mm-hmm,
whichever one you want. You could build it right now. And so anyway, that was like a standard for me. I would go through my gratitude, and then I would go make myself coffee. And, you know, I had this terrible coffee, Cafe Bustelo. And there's some Hispanic people maybe listen to this. They'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But it's a Cuban coffee. And it's just cheap. It's just cheap. I think you can get 2 pounds for $5 at Walmart. Like, so cheap. But that was one of the only coffees that they let you send in to prison from outside. So that was what a lot of people had. And it was cheap. So that's what I would drink every morning. And I would sit there and drink my black coffee. That's when I started drinking my coffee black. And the reason why I started drinking my coffee black actually was it was because the bitterness and the like earthiness, it wasn't super attractive to me. And so I sipped it. Like, that's why, like, I just liked that it forced me. One, hot coffee.
Slow down.
Yep. I'm hot coffee all the time. I don't care if it's the middle of the summer. I'm drinking hot coffee.
Same.
And black, because, like, even though I love the taste of, like, coffee with cream and sugar, but drinking it black, it just, you want to sip it. It's like whiskey, you know?
You have to.
You have to. Exactly.
You literally can't do it fast.
Yeah. And so it would take me 20 to 30 minutes just to drink the coffee, and I wouldn't do anything else.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do anything. I would just sit there. And I think that's so powerful. Like, people don't do that anymore. I just made a post on Omen Coffee Co.'s Instagram page about this, like, saying, if you want to practice mindfulness, try with your morning coffee. Like, it's the easiest thing in the world.
Do you know that? I mean, I didn't see that post actually, but I did remember the story of, like, how, like, meditative your coffee was in prison. And part of my New Year's goals that I've been doing is I drink my coffee black now,
yeah,
which is crazy because I used to say, people are like, how do you like your coffee? And I'm like, well, I like coffee with my sugar.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I would say. Yeah. And you're right. Like, when I would have the sweet coffee, I would drink it super fast.
It's so good.
It's so good. Or, like, you're so thirsty, or it makes you thirstier. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, like, I think it's very hard for a lot of people, and it definitely is hard for me to just sit in silence. I'm not at that point quite yet.
Oh, yeah.
So what I do actually is every morning I go on YouTube and I find some sort of 10-minute morning meditation.
You gotta do silence. What do you do?
Like, it's okay. It's a good start. Yeah. It's a level. Yeah, like, there's levels.
There's levels, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so, right. Like, for me, versus, like, before, I'd be, like, scrolling on, like, TikTok or something, and my brain's just firing, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So to be able to have some sort of, like,
routine. I'm telling you, it was so powerful. It was so powerful.
It is very powerful. But,
you know what's crazy to look at? Because what you were just saying is, like, you know, you'll occupy your brain, right? And it's hard to sit in silence for 10 minutes. I actually learned that when I was in solitary confinement. Like, I don't know if I told the story on GMBM, but I probably did. But when I first realized how much we all just conveniently distract ourselves 24 hours, every waking moment that we have, our brain has to be engaged on something, because to not be it, you know, you're forced to sort of sit with yourself, and that's extremely uncomfortable for people. And I didn't realize that until I went to solitary confinement, because when you go to the box in the first week or so, there's levels to that. There's, like, the intake cell that you're in, and then if you get convicted of the ticket or whatever, they give you a term that you have to serve, and then they send you to what they call the big box, which is different. But in the little box where you're in the intake, there's no talking, and if you talk, the guards will literally walk past your cell when it's meal time. So in the box, just for perspective, like, the only thing you look forward to is the next meal. Like, that's it. That's the only, it's like a reward. It's Pavlov and the dog. Like, it's, there's nothing else to look forward to. And so in the little box, also, you don't have your personal property yet. When you go to the big box, you do, and you get books and stuff like that. But in there, there's nothing. You're just in a concrete cell with no pen, no paper, no books, no, there's nothing to distract you. And you also cannot talk. And so
they literally put you in timeout.
Oh my,
that's the craziest thing.
Yeah, but, like, mentally, that is the hardest week of my whole bit.
It's 1 week?
Well, I went to the box many times, and eventually it got easier for me to do that part of it. But the first time I went, being in that little box, and you can't talk.
No, but you realize they're literally saying you need to sit in silence and think about the consequences of your actions.
100%. But doing that for days at a time, I'm telling you, It's like it's unbearable. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about to the point. This is the point I'm making actually, is when I realized how uncomfortable it makes people to sit with themselves. There would be guys that would talk to their neighbor, get caught, and they knew that they weren't going to eat if they got caught talking, and they would talk anyway because they couldn't stay quiet.
Wow.
That's when I realized, like, this dude is so uncomfortable sitting in that cell with his own thoughts that he knows he's not going to eat, and he's talking anyway. That's how it blew my mind. And that's when I realized, in that box was when it was like a really pivotal moment for me, because I realized, like, I don't know, like, that it was a make or break moment, you know, like, I just, something unlocked in me anyway. But when I've seen that recently is, we have these men's and women's groups here at Omen, and we do a journaling prompt in every group. Mm-hmm. And the men's group in particular, I don't know as much about the women's groups, but in the men's groups, we spend 10 minutes. I set a timer and I'm like, hey, we introduce the journaling prompt. Everybody has it. And I set a timer for 10 minutes. And I'm like, hey, we're going to write for 10 minutes and then we'll come back. And I will see these guys, they'll write for 3-4 minutes and then they look up and then they start chit chatting. And I had to tell them, you motherfuckers, think about this. You can't sit with yourself for 10 fucking minutes. Like, that's why you don't write. It's not that you're incapable. It's not that you don't have the thoughts. It's you cannot sit with yourself. You need somebody else to entertain you and they can't even make it to the timer. So now it's more of a challenge to keep writing for 10 minutes because it's the first time, maybe in a lot of these guys' life, that they sit with themselves undistracted and with nobody else's approval, validation, or opinion for 10 whole minutes. And it's crazy to see. It really is.
Oh, for sure.
But yeah, anyway, that's how I ended up in prison. Psychedelics.
Well, I will say though, one thing that I had asked you recently was what community meant to you, because I was like, what's your big goal here? Like with the coffee shop,
yeah.
You know, what do you want long-term?
Yeah.
And you said that it's kind of like almost like a beehive.
Yeah.
Was your vision for community. And you said the people you surround yourself with are really going to influence how you are, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
Which I thought was super powerful. So I think, like, just jumping into like the men's group, you know, like when you said that everyone's surrounding themselves and they're journaling.
Yeah.
That moment is super powerful because at home you can cheat yourself out of doing it right. But there's something about being surrounded by a group of people who are all there to do the same thing.
100%.
Levels you up.
Yeah. And a beehive is just a physical, it's a physical representation of, it's an analogy, for lack of a better word, but of the kind of environment that I'm trying to build, where, you know, there's the hive and, you know, everybody here plays a role and everybody, you know, their individual roles sort of contribute to the good of the whole. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and obviously there's so much energy, you know, contained inside of this beehive, you know, because of all the life and all the effort. But also when I think about community, I really would like to build the kind of community that I think, can be an example for the rest of our community here in St. Louis, but also the rest of the country, the rest of the world. Like, there's so much social tension in our society right now. And I really, some of it is merited. And I think in any community, there's always going to be, you know, disagreements and tension, but like, I just think that there's a much better way of going about getting to the bottom of it. I think that regardless of disagreements, we all need to come to remind ourselves that, like, we're all on the same team. We all live here. Like, it's cool. Like, our goal really should be, the object of these discussions shouldn't be to argue or to prove people wrong. It should be, how do we make this place, this specific place, any place, wherever you're sitting, but I'm sitting in the city of St. Louis. So how do we make the city of St. Louis the best place to live for all of us? That should be the goal of the discussion. It's not to, like, say, fuck you or to prove the other person wrong. It's, okay, this is how you feel. This is how I feel. here's our set of shared values. Here's our set of individual values. There's this Venn diagram where like a lot of our values do overlap, but then we also have two that are conflicting. Okay, so we have these ones over here that are conflicting. This is the discussion. The discussion is, where do we disagree? But anyway, so yeah, when you say the word community, that's not only Beehive in the sense of I'm trying to actually put businesses on this whole block. That way this block will be my Beehive and all these different businesses will be where our community spends a lot of their time. And that's why I use the Beehive analogy, because if I do that, then it will kind of literally be that. But then with building a community that I think is a good example for other communities, it's a community that's actually inclusive. Like the people that hate me the most on the internet are the people that talk about tolerance and inclusion and all these things, but they're the most intolerant people in our whole society. Cause if you don't agree with them, they're like, fuck you, fuck their business. They literally leave fake Google reviews on my business's page all the time saying 1-star review. You know, I've never been here, but the owner's not inclusive. Like, but anyway, so when I say a community that's actually inclusive, it's like, man, it drives me nuts that we've gotten to a place where we cannot agree to disagree, right? And I think that my philosophy here is like, I'm very opinionated. I'm very sure about some of the things that I think are right and wrong. And I don't really care how you feel about that. It doesn't matter how you feel about how I feel and what I think and feel and believe. The only thing that I really care about is how we treat each other when you're here. And so if I'm an atheist and you believe in God, it doesn't make any difference as long as you respect the fact that I have different beliefs than you do. That's fine.
Right.
Or if you're white and I'm black, or you're Jewish and I'm Christian, or you're gay and I'm straight, and we could go down the list. Like that's what I mean when I say an actually inclusive environment is here. You're allowed to think, feel, and believe whatever the fuck you want, but you have to respect the fact that everybody else has the same, you know, opportunity to do that as well. And so actually inclusive, actually tolerant. And then I think one thing that is really important to point out, and I just shared this with the men's group, is like those things, and then there's an asterisk below it with boundaries, right? Like with standards, like there's standards, there's boundaries. And that's where the adults in the community need to come together and say, okay, where's the line on some of these things? Where's the line? Not only that, but what is holding a high standard look like? Because there's the line, which this is where you cannot cross. For example, with me, one of those things is children. Like we're, you know, it seems to be a hot thing, but a hot subject of discussion in our country right now, but children getting gender transitions and things like that, making permanent decisions. That's one of those things for me is a line. There's a line. Right. We're not going to do that with the kids. If you're an adult and you want to do that, that's fine. But like until then, we're
going to be like an adult decision.
We're going to take some other, we're going to explore other options until they're fucking old enough to make that decision on their own.
Which I think is a fair statement, considering that there's a lot of things you have to wait to be a certain legal age to do it. So why not do that?
You can't get a tattoo. You can't fucking drink. You can't, there's so many things
get married,
that are less detrimental. Get married. Exactly. So I think that's a fair
thing. Certain big decisions that you need to be a certain level of maturity and
your brain doesn't even fully develop until you're 25. Correct. So
yeah.
But anyway, so I think that in any community, this is a productive thing to do. This is one of my primary motivations behind starting the men's and women's groups is bring the adults together. Mm-hmm. Not all the adults that agree with you. Bring them all together and say, where are the lines? Where are the hard lines? And of course, you're never going to have 100% agreement. Like that's just, and if you look all through history, most effective governments take a utilitarian approach, which is the most good for the most amount of people. Right. Or we live in a country that's supposed to be democratic, which is just, we vote on this shit.
Right.
You know? And so what do most people agree with? And I think most people would agree with you and I on this particular line, but
I would say when it comes to arguing and it comes to values, I think there has to be two points that especially in our generation, we need to take into consideration, which is one, I don't think any truly serious arguments should be had not in person.
They have to.
I have gotten into a few arguments recently with people like over text or even like voice note.
And can't do
like,
it.
You never come across the way you mean to. And like, there's certain relationships, like there's certain people who I know, like I ruined it just because like the way we both came across.
Yeah.
And then I think that's the first rule. So it has to be done in person.
Well, that's why you have, I mean, men's and women's groups. Right. These are in person.
But even only, just in people's individual lives, if they're not like around like a, you know, men's or women's group that they can go to.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that's super important is that when you're arguing with someone, my friend has this rule with her, she and her husband, I think it's brilliant, which is you never can call the person a name or start cutting them down.
Yeah, no.
You know what I mean? Like,
it's a discussion on what we're talking about. It's not about you.
To be honest, like whenever I'm having a disagreement with someone, if they start insulting me, I'm like, I feel like what's happened in this argument is you've run out of good points to make.
Oh, yeah.
And your ego is flaring up.
Yeah,
you're still
feeling
passionate about what you feel, but you also kind of feel like you have nothing else to say to me. And so you have to go to like the next level down, which is like knock me down.
Oh, you bigot. Oh, you did.
And I'm like, at that point, I'm just like, okay.
This is over.
This conversation's over. And unfortunately, like, it's really hard to fix it after that. You know?
Yeah, but. I guess
to respect
it. No, and what your first point is so powerful, and that's kind of what I kind of assume that, which is really why I was highly motivated to try to bring people together in real life and talk. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize that a lot. Just to wrap this up, and so one of the last thing that we're trying to accomplish with the community is one, get all the adults in the community on the same page about what are the boundaries. But then the other thing, which is the flip side of boundaries, that's like the minimal acceptable, you know, standard. But then the flip side is what does high standards look like? Like, why not let's all, like, going back to the question, how do we make this the best place to live for all of us? Well, we should take care of this place, right? We should have high standards. People mm-hmm. should be healthy. There should be an environment where, like, you know, so there's just so many little nuanced things that have the opportunity to enrich your life, like for real, like having real and meaningful relationships with people in real life, not your Facebook friends. Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
It's
like
never going to be the same.
Like having a healthy and thriving small business economy, like bringing crime down. Like there's just a lot of things, right? And it starts with standards, the standards that the people set. A lot of people sit around, especially in today's world, we're sitting around looking around like all the problems in the world and we're waiting for somebody to come fix them. But we don't realize that these problems have really come about. They're a result of low standards.
Right.
Like we've let ourselves, our standards drop so low that, insert here, that all this shit is happening.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But by changing yourself, you inspire those around you.
100%. But if you could do it with a group, right? What do they say? If you want to go, you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go together or whatever. When you get everybody on the same page and then you get all the adults in your community on the same page about, hey, this is the standard around here now. And then you have this collective accountability, this peer to peer accountability where now we can hold each other accountable and be like, hey man, you're better than that.
Yeah.
Hey man, you know that that's not how we do things or whatever. So anyway, that's what I mean when I say setting an example for how a community should operate. It's, I think the adults should all be on the same page. I think they should all trust each other. Trust at least that they all have the best interests of the whole in mind. And then also we should be on the same page about what are the standards around here. And then what are the hard lines that we do not cross and that what's unacceptable here. And that's the basics of any community, but it's missing in a lot of communities around the world. And I think in fact, even just the companionship, even just the public discussion is missing. Like you highlighted, people are living in these echo chambers of thoughts on the internet. They live their whole life on the internet and they don't have any real friends in real
life. Right. And they assume they understand people's meanings based on
little
snippets they get. So last question that I'm going to ask is, I love obviously your whole mentality on community and what you want to do and like your vision for growth within like St. Louis, but even less to the country or the world. But I have to ask, like, why coffee?
Well, coffee is the vehicle that I've chosen to use to like really just usher in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think coffee shops have a traditional coffee shop environment is a very welcoming space. It's conducive to productivity, but also socializing. Like it's a perfect kind of environment that to foster these kind of discussions, like good, meaningful discussions like the one that we're having right now.
Yeah.
Also, almost People from almost every single demographic drink coffee. Gay people drink coffee, straight people drink coffee, black people, white people, Jewish people, Muslim people, Christian people, like everybody drinks coffee. And so one of the things that's most immediate that we consistently work towards on a regular basis is pointing out to people that like, hey, like the shop will be buzzing. It'll be full. Everybody's good energy. Everybody's interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. And we'll just kindly point out like, hey, think about this. In here right now, there's gay people, there's straight people, there's black people, there's white people, there's people of all races, all ethnicities, all cultural backgrounds, and people who voted for Joe Biden, people who voted for Donald Trump, and you're all sitting in the same space right now, and you don't give a fuck about any of that.
Right.
That's what we like to point out.
Yeah, because people are good in the end of the day.
Because in real life, people are good. That's the truth. Yeah. It's somebody said it to me the other day. My good friend Jason Bachman, who owns a bunch of companies here in St. Louis, but he's awesome. A mentor to me right now. He says, it's hard to hate up close.
And I literally was just about to say that.
It's hard to hate up close. It is. And I love that he said that.
It's so true.
Because, and I like, that's what we work towards. Every day is just, we work to a point where we can like fill the shop up, and then we can point out to people like, hey, it's hard to hate up close, because social media, mainstream media, wherever you look, there's a narrative being propagated right now in our country. Yeah. And the narrative is, this person hates this person, or these people hate these people.
These are your differences. Or
everybody's got it out for you, and all this stuff. There's just so much division being propagated. And in real life, when you pick your fucking head up from that phone, you look around and you're forced to acknowledge what we're trying to show you right now, which is that it's hard to hate up close, man.
Yeah.
It really is. Even people that hate me. There's so many people who have come to the coffee shop. People who literally have come. This is what I hate about our culture right now. People will come here, leave a 5-star review online and be like, wow, Mark is so amazing. He was so welcoming. I got to meet the owner and the coffee was amazing, blah, blah, blah. And then 3 weeks later, the same person will circle back and leave a 1-star review and be like, I heard he's homophobic.
Oh.
You heard that where? Online? Because your experience in real life was that I was amazing. And now you heard some shit on the internet. And you, dude, that's about our culture right now. It's so fucking backwards.
It's hard to think for yourself.
It really is. It really is. But anyway, so that's why I chose coffee. It's such a good product to build around. It really is. Yeah.
I have this tradition at the end of every podcast. The whole basis of my podcast is based on this Hebrew quote.
Yeah.
Which is Eze hu chacham, halo meid mikol adam, which means one who is wise is one who learns from everyone.
Yeah.
And so we learned a lot from you and about you this episode. But if you can just leave us with one last either quote or life lesson that's really impacted you.
Yeah, the quote that comes to mind is, your job isn't to save them. It's to be the example and show them how you saved yourself.
Ooh, say that again.
Your job isn't to save them. It's to be the example and show them how you saved yourself. So that's like my
accountability.
That's just, I don't know. That quote is always the one that comes to mind when people ask me about, you know, sort of a philosophy that I live by. Yeah. That's it.
And what can we do to support you?
Drink almond coffee.
Drink almond coffee.
That's it. If you drink coffee, if you buy coffee, you should have a coffee on subscription. I got you.
If you're local,
stop by. Stop by. That's right.
And if you're not local, you ship.
Yeah.
So
I got you.
Either way.
Yeah.
This has been awesome. Thank you so much.
Really
appreciate the time. I appreciate that you let us use your space. I don't think I mentioned this, but we're actually here at Omen. We're on the second floor right now.
Yeah.
But you guys know where to find us. We are on all of the platforms where you could find podcasts. Please leave 5 stars.
Yes.
Leave great comments and obviously share with a friend. Thank you guys for coming. Thanks for listening. And hope you guys have a great week. Let's get it. Let's go.